Well, welcome back to the Intervention Podcast. Steve and I are going old school tonight, back in person. And I guess I don't think we owe you guys an apology, but maybe an explanation a little bit, just because we haven't been pumping out shit at the rate that we were. And I think we kind of let people know that March, and probably we're seeing April now, going to be a little bit funky. So Levi did move to Germany, and he's not off the show by any stretch of the imagination. It's just, I think it's taking him more time to settle in and us all time to settle in with like some kind of coherent schedule given the time difference. And we really haven't figured out what that's going to be yet. So,
yeah. And just, I think we've both been busy with shit as well. So it's been difficult, but
yeah, life, work, yeah. Organizing, you know, it's taking up time. Yeah. So, but we're back, at least for a little bit. We'll see how long.
For an episode or two.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully the episode with me on Upstream kind of tided you little piggies over a little bit. You're not Patreons. I put that out, I think. Whatever. It was it'll be the last episode we put out because my editing schedule's all screwed up too at this point.
Yeah.
But no, we'll get back at it. I mean, the show's not going anywhere. I actually really am happy to be doing this again. I feel like I was missing something, not like yelling into a microphone.
Well, I think we'll be able to yell tonight.
Although, yeah, like this is going to be back to the old days because like this is how we started, right? Like you and me sitting around drinking and me like getting progressively drunker and getting progressively madder as well.
Yeah.
But Levi's tempered that a little bit, but maybe now that daddy's not home, we can get a little angry again.
Levi's the calming influence, yeah. I guess. And the, you know, more data-driven intellectual side of this probably.
Right. But, you know, it's like, it's not like we've missed talking about anything. It's not like there's nothing going on at all.
No.
Right?
No, I mean, everything's good, right?
The world's sane and normal. We're heading into an election year where we're going to have to, you know, just buckle up and vote blue no matter who and get on with life as normal so we can all get back to brunch, you know?
Yeah. Everything's like, the world's cool, man. It's sorted out.
One thing that's really killing me is, and I don't know, I don't want to like bury the lead too much and like kind of shoot our wad over some things that we could talk about throughout the article. But like, you know, I think if we look at what's going on in Palestine, I do see if you look at like the media, like even like the Guardian, like the tone is shifting a bit.
Yeah.
In the ruling class media, even I would say it's shifting a bit. There's still all these like denunciations of like Hamas and October 7th, all this bullshit, like that they kind of have to do, I guess, for whatever reason. But like Israel killed those World Kitchen workers,
7 aid workers.
Right.
Biden was furious about it. He said so today.
He's real mad. But, and this is exactly what I'm getting to, is that the other shit I'm seeing is that, like, he's going to authorize the sale of F-15 fighter jets.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, what is, I mean, we know what is actually going on, you know, but there's obviously that contradiction because even, like, these ruling class mouthpieces are seeing the need to at least pay some lip service to it. Whereas a few months ago, they didn't have to do that at all. I guess it takes, like, you know, 30,000 dead Palestinians and God knows how many more. Right, yeah. To even like just pay that lip service, right? Which is pathetic.
Yeah.
But, you know, the pressure I think is working at some level way too slow. We need to do more, but I don't know. It's just infuriating.
And I mean, like, what was that last shit? UN vote where they passed, you know, what, demanding a ceasefire, but America fucking abstained from it.
Yeah. And Russia wanted to make it the language say a permanent ceasefire.
Yeah.
And America would have vetoed that. And they abstain and they
Russia
say.
Bad, bro.
Right. Yeah. They abstain and they say it's a non-binding resolution,
yeah,
which does not exist, which is not a thing in terms of what the UN Security Council does. They don't issue non-binding resolutions. That's not the point. Yeah. It's never been the point. And anything that the US has ever been on board on, but in terms of what the Security Council has put out, can bet your ass they never said it was non-binding.
Yeah.
That's the US. And I mean, they're going to come back up tonight, but I know you got an article from, what is it, The New Yorker?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is, it's called Time's Up, and it, you know, it's really just about, I mean, I guess he's framing this as Time's Up for the conservatives in Britain, but it's kind of a history of, since 2008, when the conservatives, you know, they've been in power, basically, I think since 2008, maybe 2010, but they've won every election since then, so they're about to surpass the Labour for, like, over 13 years in government, or whatever it is.
Is that like a record or something? Like,
I don't know if it's, I mean, not
at least in recent,
yeah,
in the recent century or whatever.
They're about to surpass like Blair and Brown's government, how long that lasted. And he goes into why Brown kind of lost a little bit. But, you know, this guy just touches on, and it's going to be interesting to see how much we can actually get through from this, because this is long. But I think at least the beginning's good. But anyway, it's called Time's Up. It's by a guy called Sam Knight. The kind of byline is, the conservatives have ruled Britain for almost 14 years. What have they done to the country?
So I like how we're already limiting ourselves in terms of framing of what's possible.
Yeah.
Like, we've had 14 years, as you said, or however many it was, 13 years 13, of like
14, yeah.
Neoliberal Blair.
Yeah.
Blairism, whatever you want to call it, which is just Reaganism and the Clintonism, and it's all the same shit anyway.
Yep.
Right. But like, again, it's like this inherent reactionary framing from the beginning. It's like, we need to go back to what Labour's proposing. Cause like, we'll get into this, I'm sure. But like, what is Keir Starmer proposing that's new, right? That like would actually meet the needs in the moment? Nothing. They have no juice. We'll get into that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, yeah. This guy doesn't go into that, but I'm sure we'll talk about it. But anyway, so the beginning's kind of just like a little bit about him growing up, and then goes into the Conservative Party. And again, we'll see how far we get and how much we talk about. Maybe we'll do a second part on, because he does go into some good details about how fucked up Britain is. And regardless of where we stand, Britain is fucked up.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
and, you know, it was probably good for the general person under Blair, because I think at that time life was a little, you know, everything was making money, right? So if you lived in a capitalist society, almost everything was making money. So regardless of your politics, if you worked, and we all work unfortunately in a capitalist world right now, you were probably doing quote unquote okay.
Yeah. If you lived in like the West in the 90s, West.
Yeah, yeah, sorry,
and you had like some kind of, I mean, things were already declining at that point. Right. Yeah. But like, I think
it was harder to see than it is now.
And the West was still riding the high of the fall of the Soviet Union. Like,
yeah,
don't get us wrong. There was people that were still absolutely suffering, but people were doing well-ish.
Yeah. It was easier to hide the decline of these countries at that point.
I also wonder, though, because I was younger in the 90s, obviously, and I wonder how much of that is just like a veneer
that's put on.
That like things were good, and like the stories that we hear about it, and like that effort to kind of like bring things back.
Yeah.
In terms of putting that out into the zeitgeist, because I'm sure there was some awful like suffering and shit going on for the working class as well. But I do think there is probably a
fucking Iraq war for one.
Right. There is probably something to the fact that like, maybe let's say like the fictitious middle class, like that middle segment of the working class was maybe feeling a little bit okay.
Yeah.
I'll grant that.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll start this. So this article begins. My life divides evenly enough into three political eras. I was born in 1980, a year after Margaret Thatcher entered Downing Street, with a prayer of St. Francis of Assisi on her lips. Where there is doubt, may we bring faith. And where there is despair, may we bring hope. I don't think she brought much hope to people, but anyway. The conservative-run Britain of the 80s was not harmonious. Life beyond the North London Square, where my family lived, often seemed to be in the grip of one confrontation after another. The news was always showing police on horseback. There were strikes, protests, the IRA, and George Michael on the radio. My father, who was a lawyer in the city, traveled to Germany to buy a Mercedes and drove it back elated. Until Thatcher resigned when I was 10, her steeply back combed hair and deep, impossible voice played an outsized role in my imagination. A more interesting, more dangerous version of the Queen. I was nearly 17 when the Tories finally lost power to Tony Blair. A new Labour, an updated, market-friendly version of the party. Before he moved to Downing Street, Blair lived in Islington, the gentrifying borough I was from. Boris Johnson, an amusing right-wing columnist who was getting his start on television, also lived nearby. Our local member of parliament was an out-of-touch leftist named Jeremy Corbyn.
So this guy's cool.
I mean, is he saying that like tongue-in-cheek?
I think he kind of is, but he's definitely a liberal. Like,
right.
You read through this, I mean, he's critical of the right. And I think he's also a little critical of I mean, he's kind of dismissive of Keir Starmer at one point, which I think is accurate. I mean, I don't, he's, like you said, he's not right. going to do anything.
So you don't even think, because I mean, like, let's be real, like Corbyn's kind of a liberal as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's better than anyone else.
No, but he's still like a social democrat, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Like, I don't know what the guy has in his head, but like he would govern as a social democrat.
I would. He'd be forced to, even if he didn't want to, right?
Right.
Kind of like Gordon Brown. Like, I think Gordon Brown was a lot more left than Tony Blair, but he was kind of forced to be in this new Labour thing. It'd be interesting with Corbyn now, because, you know, he got in trouble for like the pro-IRA, pro-Palestine stance. Mm. So it'd be interesting if like what had all that backlash happened now,
yeah,
if it'd be any different. Anyway, so New Labour believed in the responsibility of the state to look after its citizens and in capitalism to make them prosper. Seems a little bit of a contradiction there, but anyway. Blair was convincing, even when he was wrong. And I know we keep sidetracking, but I think that is a very good and like prudent point. Blair is similar to Obama in the sense of, I think they're possibly the two best politicians of my lifetime.
In terms of just how they speak in and terms present of politicians, themselves and the charisma.
Yeah. Like Obama could say nothing and just sway thousands of people and make them believe in what he was saying. I think I mentioned on the podcast before, I don't know if you listened to it on that, what was it? The West Wing thing.
Yeah.
There's a guy, I forget who it was, who was one of their guests. And he said that he had sat for an interview with Obama and recorded it. And like gone back and told his wife like how amazing this guy was. And he was said to his wife, like, you need to listen to this. And she said, don't listen, read what he says. And he was like, you're right. He doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Blair was the same. He was a great politician, but
yeah, yeah, exactly. In that like really liberal sense where it's just about the aesthetics.
Yeah. Right. So he won 3 general elections in 10 years and walked out of the House of Commons to a standing ovation, undefeated in his eyes. I was turning 30 when Labour eventually ran out of road, undone by the Iraq War, the global financial crisis, and the grim temper of Gordon Brown, Blair's successor. Brown was caught on a hot mic moment describing an ordinary voter who was complaining about taxes and immigration as a bigot. And again, like, he was probably right, but again, he wasn't smooth like Blair.
Sure.
He was just not, you know, the same type of politician. But anyway. Since then, it's been the Conservatives again. In 2010, the party returned to government in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. Since 2015, it has held power alone. Last May, the Tories surpassed the 13 years and 9 days that New Labour had held office. But the third political era of my lifetime has been nothing like the previous two. There has been no dominant figure or overt political project. No Thatcherism, no Blairism. Instead, there has been a quickening, lowering churn. 5 prime ministers, 3 general elections, 2 financial emergencies, a once-in-a-century constitutional crisis, and an atmosphere of tired, almost constant drama.
Because this whole project is out of juice.
Yeah.
Like, the neoliberal project, like, I'm not saying that, like, it means we're going to go into, like, socialism or anything like that, but, like, there needs to be, if the liberals are going to maintain power, and I'm including conservatives, labor,
yeah,
just, you know, Democrats here, right? Whatever you want to call machine. It, everything that's yeah. part of this kind of whole neoliberal hellscape for the past 40 years that we've been living in. I mean, they're going to have to reinvent it in some way. Like, I don't know if it's going to, likely it'll take a more fascistic kind of turn, but like this project of like, globalization to the benefit of, you know, the capitalist class and shredding labor unions and everything. Like, there's nothing left to be squeezed out of it. And like the dynamics are completely different with the rise of like more of a multipolar world at this point in time. You know, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting as well, because as I almost think Britain is maybe in a better position to weather this than America's going to be, in the sense of maybe not coming out as a completely fascist country. I don't know if I'm just saying that because it's where I'm from, or because it's an older...
Well, it's already fallen in some ways, right?
Like, exactly.
The British Empire's already fallen.
We've already had...
The fall was cushioned by the US.
Yes. And, you know, the US won't be there anymore, but as well, I just think that, you know, it's fallen and they've had their disaster the last 20 years. You know, it's been a shithole for a while. I think the collapse is more accelerated there, and maybe they'll come out of it a little bit better than America. I mean, I fear for America in the sense of we could become overtly fascist. You know, right now we're basically fascist anyway, but like real bad.
That's the thing. It's like, but like it's,
and it doesn't matter who wins the next election, by the way.
No. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. No,
it's even like, though it's the most important.
We're talking about like funding a genocide.
Yeah.
Stormtroopers in New York subways. I mean, I know it's the National Guard. I don't want to be like exaggeratory, but like, you know, you've got like a police state kind of imposed where people, like an armed group of people, are like searching people's bags just to get on public transport.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about this and like you went back and read that in a history book, right? Like if we read that about, God forbid, like the Soviet Union, right? Like, oh, yeah, the way they took that.
An authoritarian hellscape.
Right.
In terms of education, how they taught it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the period is bisected by the United Kingdom's decision in 2016 to leave the European Union, a conservative fantasy or nightmare, depending on whom you talk to. Brexit catalyzed some of the worst tendencies in British politics. Its superficiality, nostalgia, and love of gameplay, and exhausted the country's political class, leaving it ill-prepared for the pandemic and the twin economic shocks of the war in Ukraine and the 49-day experimental premiership of Liz Truss. Covering British politics during this period has been like trying to remember and explain a very convoluted and ultimately boring dream. If you really concentrate, you can recall a lot of details, but that doesn't lead you closer to any meaning. I think that's kind of interesting as well, in the sense of like, I think that's the point of some of these governments. They just want you to kind of forget about details and just like, you can remember some shit, but like, just don't worry. Things will be, you know, things are going to get better. You don't have to worry about too much. You're just, you know, just kind of dreamily go through life and everything will be fine.
Absolutely. I mean, they don't want us organized. I mean, the whole neoliberal project was to decimate like labor organizations specifically, or at least that was a component of it.
Yeah.
And they want you to think that, I mean, that's like the end of history idea, right? There's no other alternative possible.
Yeah.
And that's just like, I mean, we're seeing that unwind like agonizingly right now, that idea.
Yeah.
Because we know just based on history, like the Democrats and the Republicans, like it's the Democrats versus the Republicans, labor versus the Tories in Britain, like, this is not going to go on until the sun fucking implodes on itself. It can't. That's not how history works, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, continuing. Last year, I started interviewing conservatives to try and make sense of these years. One always starts with disclaimers now. I didn't start this car crash. Julian Glover, a former speechwriter for David Cameron, the longest-serving prime minister of the period, told me. I spoke to MPs and former cabinet ministers, political advisors who helped to make major decisions, and civil servants, local government officials, and frontline workers hundreds of miles from London who had to deal with the consequences. Some people insisted that the past decade and a half of British politics resists satisfying explanation. The only way to think about it is a psychodrama enacted, for the most part, by a small group of middle-aged men who went to elite private schools, studied at the University of Oxford, and have been climbing and chucking one another off the ladder of British public life. The curus honorum, I think I said that right, as Johnson once called it, ever since. The Conservative Party, whose history goes back some 350 years, aids this theory by not having anything as vulgar as an ideology. They're not on a mission to do X, Y, or Z. A former advisor explained, you win and you govern because we are better at it, right?
But what is, like, I'm interested to see, and I like, what is he saying that the alternative of labor is?
I don't think he's saying anything right now. He's just criticizing the Tories.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about that, but like,
and really throughout this, I don't see him give an answer. He just kind of.
Right. And like, that's what I want to think about, right?
Right.
It's because, yeah, of course. Like, because like, in the same way that you're saying, but like, we could flip that back on its head and be like, but what are the Tories presenting as like the alternative to labor, that same labor fucking system? You know what I mean? To that same kind of ideology where it's like, as we've already said, just govern and we'll go about our merry way. We just need to get these people in here. But we've done that before.
Yeah, their Labour is an updated market-friendly version of the party.
Did he say that?
That's what he said earlier. And what did he say? It was they believed in responsibility of the state to look after its citizens and capitalism to make them prosper. We did that article. I mean, going way, way back, we did that article on Blair and Clinton, right?
Yeah.
They're the same animal.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's why, like, we have to think about, like, you know, people like associate reactionary politics with like that word conservative.
Yes.
But like Labour, as it's currently constituted, the Democrats, they are a force of reaction holding us back from progressive change.
Yes.
And like, that's what we need to all, like in Britain, in here, we need to come to terms with that, that this is a reactionary force pulling back the levers of progress. I know our listeners know that.
Yeah.
But like, I always like to interrogate like how these articles are actually structured and like look at like what their flaws are, because this is a lot of media writ large in terms of mainstream stuff.
Yeah.
And like, we're going to see more and more of this, right? As like the machine cranks into gear to try to get like here, like Biden reelected, even though he's funding a fucking genocide.
Yeah. Okay. So, Sam Knight continues. Another way to think about these years is to consider them in psychological or theoretical terms. In Heroic Failure, the Irish journalist Fintan O'Toole explains Brexit by describing Britain's fall from imperial nation to occupied colony of the EU, and the rise of a powerful English nationalism as a result. Last year, Abby Innes, a scholar at the London School of Economics, published Late Soviet Britain, Why Materialist Utopias Fail, which argues that since Thatcher, Britain's political mainstream has become as devoted to particular ideas about running the state, a default commitment to competition, markets, and forms of privatization, as Brezhnev's USSR ever was. The resulting regime, Innes writes, has proved anything but stable. These observations are surely right, but I worry that they obscure two basic truths about Britain's experience since 2010. The first is that the country has suffered grievously. These have been years of loss and waste. The UK has yet to recover from the financial crisis that began in 2008. According to one estimate, the average worker is now £14,000 worse off per year than if earnings had continued to rise at pre-crisis rates. It is the worst period for wage growth since the Napoleonic Wars. Nobody who's alive and working in the British economy today has ever seen anything like this, Torsten Bell, the chief executive of the Resolution Foundation.
That's bad.
Yeah. Which published the analysis, told the BBC last year, this is what failure looks like.
Yeah.
Yep.
I want to, at some point, like maybe as like a supplement to this, we should try to find out like what the British left is up to.
Yeah, I looked a little bit on, it's like the Communist Party of Britain. I looked a little bit about their website, and I didn't see any articles that I was going to bring up tonight, but I will look at that again.
Yeah, I just like wonder is like, I mean, and it's got to be the case, like the left, and I say this as a communist organizer, like we're weak as fuck in this moment.
Yeah.
And like you can use these moments to build, right? Because like material conditions are obviously not even like they're deteriorated. Like that is a horrific situation for working people.
Yes.
Like to be £14,000 worse off than you were.
Yeah.
Which I mean, you say that like, and it sounds like kind of hits you like a gut check, but like, then you think about it for a second. It's like that probably tracks when you look at like inflation.
Yeah.
And like, as you were saying in the article, like the stagnation of wages, how we all know, like we know it, like even like, you don't need, a working person doesn't need like these statistics to know that they're fucking worse off when you have to pay $6 for a bag of Doritos.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Well, you know, yeah. Wages are going down. House prices are going up. Like everything is, it's harder for a working person to survive now.
Right. Yeah. So I just like, it'd be interested to see what like the British left is doing to try to organize and grow power within this moment.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to get someone on to actually talk about it because I live here. So I'm out
of
touch.
Yeah. So, and like how they're relating to like the failure of like the imperialist system that they had a huge part in birthing in terms of like a left politic to move forward and like anti-imperialism, right? Because right. I guarantee you there are some, in the same way as here, there's still like, there's a growing anti-imperialist movement, but it's still pretty fringe. Like, again, like yeah. as optimistic as I need to be in terms of where we could go, we have to be real and say that like, we're still fringe.
Yeah. Definitely.
You know,
yeah.
Like there's this mass outcry against Palestine, but like we still have to do the work to kind of pull that and articulate it into like a political movement. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, why is this happening?
It's a lot easier to be against something when you see kids starving on TV than it is to be like, oh, we drone struck Syria. Like, who yeah. gives a shit? That imperial.
Yeah, because Assad bad.
Yeah, exactly. Like that, or we need to send more money to Ukraine, or send, you know, if
Putin bad.
Yeah, exactly. But you know,
like I guess like the point that I'm making here is like, without an anti-imperialist left driving change, we're never gonna, in my opinion, we're never gonna escape this doom loop, this death loop. We're not.
It's just the malaise that we're all in.
Yeah. Kind of. And like the left in the imperial core, and I say left, you know, in quotes a little bit, right? Because I'm starting to really loathe the term leftist. You know what I mean? Because like it's too all encompassing. Like there's people that you'd call leftists that like I probably can't work with. Like maybe on certain things I can work with, but like there's leftists that.
Dude, according to fucking half the right, Biden's a leftist. I mean,
right. You know what I mean? Like, so yeah. that term, I hate it, you know, yeah. but like without like a Marxist Leninist, actual bona fide, like anti-imperialist movement, like we're never going to get out of this malaise.
No, no. Okay. Continuing, high levels of employment and immigration coupled with the enduring dynamism of London mask a national reality of low pay, precarious jobs, and chronic underinvestment. The trains are late, the traffic is bad, the housing market is a joke. The core problem is easy to observe, but it's tough to live with, Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England, told me. It is just not that productive an economy anymore. With stagnant wages, people's living standards have fallen. In 2008, Brown's Labour government commissioned Michael Marmot, a renowned epidemiologist, to come up with ways to reduce England's health inequalities. Marmot made suggestions in six policy areas, including better access to childcare, walking and cycling programs, social security reforms, and measures to improve people's sense of agency at work. In 2010, he presented his ideas to the incoming conservative-led coalition, which accepted his findings. I thought, wow, this is great. I was pretty bullish about the whole thing, Marmot told me. The problem was they didn't do it. 10 years later, Marmot led a follow-up study in which he documented stalling life expectancy, particularly among women in England's poorest communities, and widening inequalities. For men and women everywhere, the time spent in poor health is increasing, he wrote. This is shocking. According to Marmot, the UK's health performance since 2010, which includes rising infant mortality, slowing growth in children, and the return of rickets, makes it an outlier among comparable European nations. The damage to the nation's health need not have happened, Marmot concluded in 2020. He told me it was a political choice.
Sure, it is. But you know what also would have been a political choice? Labor doing that shit during the Cameron or Blair eras.
Well, Cameron was a Tory.
Sorry. Or yeah, Blair or during Brown. The Blair era.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, so Brown commissioned this guy. So I guess you can... I guess the assumption is because Brown commissioned him, if Brown hadn't been kicked out in 2010, he would have enacted this stuff. But we can't prove that. We don't know that.
We can't know that, but no. Like, I don't buy it.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and I'm only challenging it in that because like I'm going to continue to challenge the fundamental premise of this article because I feel like that guy, again, like as a liberal columnist would do here, pin all the failures of the system on Trump. And Trump has a lot of shit to, you know, he has a lot of sins that he must atone for, but so does Biden and so does Clinton and so does Obama. You know what I mean? It's just like, I want to draw the parallels between this system.
Yeah.
And like the assumptions of what makes this article so flawed in terms of we need to get to solutions.
Right.
And like going back to a Keir Starmer, which is what the alternative is right
and
now.
And what's going to happen? He's going to win the next election.
Sure. But like, do we really expect those type of programs to be implemented, which would undoubtedly be good? You know, I mean, under a social democratic framework, they'd still help people.
Right? I think Corbyn would have done them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do.
Or he would have tried, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's
in the same way that Bernie, I think, would have tried.
Yeah. But I think another factor in this, and I don't know if we'll get to it, but he talks about schools later in the article, and about how, you know, the defunding of schools. I think that's something that we can see happening in this country.
Yeah.
The right is actively trying to like defund schools. And, you know, I hope I don't have to say this, but we're in agreement that like the Democrats and the Republicans, neither are going to solve these problems.
Right.
But certain things potentially could be accelerated under the Republicans. But the Democrats are going to do nothing to counteract that or nothing to help protect these institutions like healthcare, like schools, like childcare, like women's rights, trans rights, all these things that should be human rights and protected. Neither party is going to do anything to help them. But under the Republicans, we are going to see an acceleration of like defunding. And it's more like, you know, you see these, what are these, Moms for Liberty and all this shit. There's an active program to like get rid of public schools mm-hmm. in this country.
Yeah, to do the charter
school
thing.
And I think
it's
the same in England now as well. And to get people into like charter schools or private schools where they can dictate what the curriculum's going to be. That's a little scary, but it's still not enough to make me vote for Bernie or Biden.
And that's the thing. It's like, I'm on your team if you fight that, but I'm mm-hmm. not on your team if you do nothing to stop it when you actually have power.
And that's the thing
I'm not on your team. Like, you don't get my vote. I'm not in your fucking party. Yeah.
And that's what the Democrats don't understand.
Yeah.
They blame the left when they lose. And I'm talking about like the real left. Like they always, like when Trump won, it was the left's fault because they didn't vote for Hillary, right? If Biden had done fucking anything to help people, real working people, maybe he would have got some fucking votes in this next election that he's probably going to lose. But he's not going to now. And like, put Gaza aside and let's just talk about domestic shit, right? Because that's a whole nother thing that's going to lose him a shit ton of votes, like fucking obviously and justifiably. But just if he had done healthcare or done anything to protect schools or any of the abortion that was like Obama
Roe,
was
like, let's not forget about Roe getting overturned.
Obama was going to make it a law. And then as soon as he got elected, I've got more important things to do. Like, and now they're just running on the fact that Republicans are going to get rid of it when they did nothing to protect it for all these years. They do nothing and then think that they can blame other people for not voting for them.
Dude. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm telling you. So like, I'm not going to give this person's exact position or anything, but in the context of like local Palestine organizing, I was talking to a local Republican politician, and I'll just leave it at that. And they are a never Trumper Republican, but I was still talking to them because they're my representative. And we were trying to figure out how we could get like a certain resolution passed with respect to a ceasefire and support for a ceasefire in Gaza, right? And as I was talking to this person, it became obviously apparent that I was like a quote unquote progressive, right? I eventually told them that I was a socialist when they started shitting on socialists. And I was like, well, I am one and like, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But after the point that they had acknowledged like respect for my intelligence and things, and then I kind of dropped it. I was like, well, you know, if you think that I'm okay, then anyway, that's besides the point. But they mentioned that they're not voting for Trump. I don't know if that means that they're going to vote for Biden or whatever, but like they're one of these never Trumper type Republicans who are completely like, they're divorced from the moment because Trump actually has like, you know, he appeals to people in the sense that he's saying, fuck it all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And he's not question. He's not actually executing on that, but rhetorically, like he's speaking to people.
He speaks to people. Yeah, yeah.
The system is fucked and it's not serving us. You know, he's serving these big institutions and things. Like, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. I'm not saying anything with respect to that he's actually going to help working people, because he's not. He's a fucking capitalist. He's part of the ruling class. Anyway, I said, well, I'm not voting for Biden. And they're like, you're just going to hand it to Trump? I said, I'm going to hand it to Trump? I was like, listen, we're talking in the context of Gaza right now, but to your point exactly, I said, there was a lot of us that weren't going to vote for Biden before this.
Yeah.
Before all this went down, for exactly what you're saying, and that like he didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Anything, folks. And then now you're adding on, he's funding a genocide that we can all watch live stream through our phones with our tax dollars. I said, a lot of people now are going to pick a hill to die on, because it's not enough to just say, I'm not this.
Right.
You need to be able to leverage, like, even within the context of like this bullshit political bourgeois capitalist system, like, even if you want to play politics in that level, like, you still have to actually weaponize and leverage your demands at some level, right? And I said exactly to them, I was like, if we're so important that we could lose him this election, then he should listen to us.
Yeah, exactly. And he's not going to.
Right.
Ever. Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to think what I was listening to. It was probably some right-wing shithead. But they were making the point that, like, if you go back in time, the right was always the party that talked to the quote-unquote elites, big corporations, capitalists, all that stuff. And the Democrats were the party that talked to the working class. And that changed. I think the thread line of the conversation was that changed under Clinton, where the Democrats were like, we don't need the working class anymore. And probably because of like the tech boom and all the other shit that was happening in the 90s when Clinton was in, we just need, all we need now are the
donor class.
We need the donor class and oppressed minorities and oppressed groups will still vote for us because of historically we've been the party that, that sided with them. And that I think I mentioned to you, I was at some talk that Nate Silver gave and he said, this is the first time, and again, take it for what it is, you guys. But he was saying, this is the first time you can see, you can actively see African-Americans, Asian-Americans, Latinos, or Latin-Americans, all these minority groups voting for Republicans. Like, it's or at something,
least leaving the Democratic Party.
Yeah, it's something you can see now. And it goes to your point, like, Trump's not going to do anything for these people. But to some extent, they don't feel invisible to him.
Yeah, they don't want the same. Class. They know that this shit that they're saying,
they
like everything's okay.
They probably to some point know that he's not going to help them, but at least he talks to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you, I mean, Clinton didn't go to any of these people to talk to, and people asked, you know, again, it was the left's fault that Clinton lost. She didn't campaign to any of these people. She just thought, I'll talk to my donors. That's all I need to do. And so there's this huge percentage of working class Americans that feel invisible. And again, like, Trump at least talks to them.
Right. And this is like where I want to get to, like, practically for us on the left, like, instead of just sitting around and complaining, you know what I mean? Which is a little bit what we're doing and it's fun and it's nice. And I think it's good to think about these things, you know, but like, if we actually want to practically like change the world, like, we have to get out of like this liberal mindset of like, oh, well, if they're going to vote for Trump, then fuck them. Because that is like the Democratic Party mindset. I'm not saying to go out and like organize with the fucking Proud Boys and shit like that.
Yeah.
But to your point, there's people that probably do realize that Trump's not going to do anything, but they want to throw a middle finger to the system because the system is fucking them.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So again,
I said, ignore fucking them is probably a better description.
Yeah, no, it's what's going on, right?
Yeah.
So again, like, putting like the committed fascists, whatever, aside. And I'm not saying the last episode we did that I did on Upstream was talking about like the error of like patriotic socialism and MAGA communism and all this kind of bullshit.
Right.
But you cannot write off broad swaths of the working class as like irredeemably reactionary.
Yeah.
Because then you're setting yourself up, if you're a communist that is ostensibly dedicated to organizing the working class to take political power to actually improve the lot of that class of people, you're setting yourself up for failure if you're going to write this. Like, you have to do the work of going out and educating these people and speaking to those grievances, those very real grievances. Like,
yeah.
Don't tell somebody that like they're not feeling economic pain because groceries are, they're feeling that. They're right. Going to think you're nuts if you say, oh, well, you know, this is actually what, but no, it's bad. The system sucks.
Yeah.
Fuck it. We need to do something different.
Yeah. I mean, that's the interesting thing when I talk to like a lot of the liberal, you know, people that we know, they're like, well, if you really look at it, the economy's good. People are just too stupid to realize.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, that's you're fucking, you've got a losing argument there. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. And like, this is something like just to the point about like the donor class and everything. This is something that Comrade Brett O'Shea says a lot on like Rev Left in terms of being on the same team that I was mentioning. Like, we're not on the same, like Jeff Bezos and Zuckerberg are like Democratic Party members.
Yeah.
We're not on their team.
No.
We're not, we do not share their interests, their political interests.
You don't have a compound in Hawaii?
No. No. That was a long tangent.
Yeah, it was fun. So anyway, so I closed the last part when he was talking about that marmot saying, you know, it was a political choice not to fund the declining health in England. So he, Sam Knight continues, and that is the second all too obvious fact of British life throughout this period. A single party has been responsible. So that kind of goes to exactly everything we've just said.
Right.
It's not a single party.
Right. Yeah, we don't need to relitigate it, but yeah.
You cannot say that the country has been ruled against its will. Since 2010, the Tories have emerged as the winner of the popular vote and is the largest party in Parliament in three elections. In December 2019, Boris Johnson won an 80-seat majority in the House of Commons, the Conservatives' biggest electoral success since the heyday of Thatcherism.
See that, and that feels a little bit like the liberal blame game kind of shit. Yeah. You know, like, it wasn't against the people's will, right? Like, when we know that, like, this system is set up to be against the people's will.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, a lot of that was, and I think he kind of touches on it. I don't think he's explicit in how he says it, but I think it goes into, so the Tories or the conservatives, like systematic defunding of social programs in the poorest areas of the country throughout this period from 2010 to 2019, making these people worse off, and then blaming immigrants and saying, it's immigration's fault. We need Brexit and we need you to vote for us. And like, again, it goes to the fact that like Boris Johnson spoke to these people more than the Labour were speaking to them at the point. And like around, I can't remember off the top of my head when Corbyn took over the Labour Party, because he would have talked to them. But I think at that point, the damage had kind of been done.
Yeah. And I guess that's my point is that like, yeah, like there is some racism that's built into that, right?
Yes.
And like, but if we're actually trying to change the situation, like we can't write off that entire thing. Maybe we have to acknowledge that there needs to be some, like, again, talking to and explaining these issues. And then like, once things are like explained, like we have to trust people. Like we don't want to like come at it from the perspective of like, we need to go in and lecture at people such that they internalize like our viewpoints. Right. Like we want to go in, listen to grievances, understand those. Right.
Yeah.
And like talk about issues in a way that can, in a dynamic process, get people to see through this obfuscation, this scapegoating, because that's what it is, you know? And like, we have to trust people to be good enough and intelligent enough, because working people are,
you know? That's the point I was going to make, is that I think when you look at the Democrats like Clinton and all these people, and the same in England, there's a view, and I think kind of like, you know, We made the comment that Brown said that, you know, anybody that complains about taxes and immigration are bigots. There's this view that certain percentage of the working class are unintelligent, ignorant, and they're not.
It's the basket of deplorables thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Did.
Yeah. And you know, they're not. They just see their material conditions. And the other thing, the other side of it is that, like, you know, some person that went to Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard or Yale and views these people as like unread or whatever else is completely ignoring the fact that like capitalism is beating these people down to the fact that like maybe they just don't fucking have time to read whatever intellectual books you feel they should read because they have to work a fucking 12-hour shift every day, go home and raise their kids in a situation where childcare and healthcare is declining. And if you just talk to them and realize these people aren't ignorant or stupid, they just need someone to talk to them.
Yeah. And like someone like, and a structure that can actually like help meet those needs. Like I'm telling you, like on the left, like what we need to, and I'm not coming up with any kind of new concept. Like, I mean, people have written chapter and verse about like structures of like dual power and how to actually build community. But like, I'm thinking about it a lot because I just read that book you gave me on the Black Panthers.
Yep.
Right. Like Black Against Empire.
Yep.
Why? And I'm really thinking hard about like what made the Panthers so successful, because they were, it was enormous in like 2-3 years, you know, like they were right. probably in 3 years, they built like the most significant, like militant left wing party in the history of the United States, like full stop.
Yeah.
Yep. And what made them so successful was that they went out to these communities and they met a need. They saw an issue that they could address. And it started with like standing up to police brutality.
Yeah.
With the politics of armed self-defense. Now, the political landscape changed and everything, right? But like, if you can go out, if you can get organized on the left to an extent that you can go out to these communities and internalize what that need might be to give people more time, to protect them, to feed their fucking kids, whatever it might be. And like, you don't need to start with like, hey, become a communist. Right. Like, hey, we're communist, like we're left, we're socialists, we're communists, we're doing this stuff for you, and this is why. And take them through that process of education and actually meeting a material need, then you can build a movement. You know what I mean? And I, again, like I'm just thinking about that, like in terms of like how the left can actually like win people to the cause and get away from being like, you know, a fringe ideology that's easily discredited.
Yeah.
Like we have to actually get in touch with people.
Yep. Yep. Okay. So again, we just finished saying that, you know, the conservatives won that biggest electoral success since Thatcherism. So it continues. How is this possible? The opposition has been underwhelming. For years, Labor drifted and squabbled under two unconvincing leaders, Ed Miliband and Corbyn, my old Islington MP. I mean, I argue a little bit against Corbyn, against his position here. That, I mean, Miliband was a fucking idiot, but I mean, Corbyn, I think he tried, and again, he got tarnished with that like anti-Semite and anti-English brush, because he's a socialist that supported fucking Palestine and the IRA, which if you're a socialist,
right,
you're fucking going to.
Now my question is like, did he leave the Labor Party?
He was kicked out.
He was kicked out.
Yeah.
Do you think he would have left, or do you think that like...
No, I think he would have tried. I think he would have really tried to push them further left.
But like,
I think he would have tried to, but like whether he could have, I don't know. And, you know, again, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before. When I talked to my uncle about Corbyn, my uncle loves Corbyn. He's definitely a socialist. And his position is like, whether I sympathize with the IRA or not, you cannot say that in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's his, he's like, he should have just kept that to himself. And I'm like, well, I mean, it's kind of going against your beliefs, but it's, you know, I don't know that's the position he had. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what he would have done. And I don't think any of us know what he would have done. I think whether, you know, the Tories are obviously at a crisis point now, like they're going to lose the next election and Labor will win. Probably pretty, they should win pretty convincingly. But again, it's like Starmer's Labor. And whether Corbyn's Labor would have done that, I don't know. Because I think there's a lot of centrists in England that just viewed him as a socialist and wouldn't have voted for him.
I guess
that's your question.
No, I guess my question is more, I mean, it's part of my question. But the question that I think is more interesting is like, let's even just detach it from like, personality, the person of Corbyn himself, right? And let's compare it to Bernie. Because I think to frame this, there's a point where people that supported Bernie, and probably like a lot of people, not just a point, but multiple points where like people would have said like the thing for Bernie to do to actually kind of like consolidate, like even if it wasn't like a majority, but like a strong, dedicated minority of people would be to actually break from the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And like pull that articulation of the politics that he actually stood for into a new, maybe the genesis of a working class party. I'm getting a little bit speculative.
I know what you mean. You know what I mean? But I think the one thing you have to consider in that is that is the historical context of the parties. The Democratic Party has never been a socialist party. The Labor Party is supposed to be a socialist party. So I think Corbyn probably felt he could bring it back to maybe what it was supposed to be.
Mm. That still feels like a detachment from like the moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like yeah.
To put it like that, it really does, because like you have to recognize what the previous 40 years have been. And like, I think Jeremy Corbyn's like, I mean, I know he goes to Palestine rallies and things like that. And I guess I'm not trying to criticize him as like a personal, like, you know, again, I'm trying to understand like what kind of forces would have been present to actually support. And I'm not expecting us to answer that. It's just an interesting question to me. Yeah. But like, if he did pull away, how many people, like in the same way that like so many people in the US are disillusioned with the two-party system? Because I know a lot of like people that like Trump that also liked Bernie, like especially in 2016.
Right.
Because of what he articulated in terms of how the system was fucking people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's like you, like what you said, like just giving the middle finger to the system.
And
so
I'm, and I know they're not exactly the same places, but I mean, we've been talking about it like they're analogous and they're running in parallel all night anyway.
Yeah.
So if he had, and again, this only goes so far, but it kind of speaks to like, I guess the question of like where the masses in England are in general, but like if you could pull away, if you could break away out of that, like party, this duopoly within this bourgeois political system that exists in both countries, could you generate that like support to at least again?
Well, I mean, in England, you definitely could, because it's not as much of a duopoly as it is here.
Right.
Because you have the Liberal Democrats, you have the Green Party, you have the SNP, you have all these different parties that form coalitions. So yeah, I think that you would probably in England be a lot more effective doing that.
Well, and right. And like, so anything at this stage in the game is necessarily going to be built upon coalition. You're not going to build like this mass working party, like just because Corbyn makes a break.
Yeah.
I'm just like wondering how effective it would have been for him to form a break with the intention of like immediately working upon coalitions to build into like a more unified working class political structure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure some of it was just romanticization of the historical Labor Party and his, you know.
Well, in the same way that they appeal to like FDR here and shit, you know.
Who's the Scottish guy we've talked about before? He just won a seat again.
Galloway?
Yeah, Galloway. So, I mean, like he was a Labour Party guy who broke away and formed his own thing.
Right.
And he's just won a seat again.
Mm-hmm.
And he's back in Parliament. So, yeah.
Yeah, because if you're like a swaggering, like, fuck you guy that can get into this system, like in the same way that Trump is, like you're going to get some attention.
Yeah, because I think what will be more interesting in American politics and just, I mean, is Trump really a Republican?
I mean, and that's the thing that's part of his appeal is that like he governs as a Republican, but he still fucking calls out these old corrupt pieces of shit.
And to my point would be, it would almost be more interesting if Trump ran as an independent just to destroy the two-party system.
Yeah.
Because he probably would still win anyway. Maybe.
I don't know. I mean, he'd pull a lot of people.
Yeah. And so like,
he might not win, but he would break the illusion of the two-party system, I think, at some level.
That would almost be more interesting in the current thing. Because then it would just open it up to all kinds of different people.
But he wouldn't do that because he doesn't actually believe in that.
No, of course. He gives a shit about his power, and he just sees his ability himself to gain power is to run as a Republican.
It's through the Republican Party.
Yeah. Okay, so it is telling that since Labour elected Keir Starmer, an unimaginative former prosecutor with a rigidly centrist program, sounds a lot like Kamala Harris, actually. That the party is competitive again. But the Conservatives have not survived by default. Their party has excelled at diminishing Britain's political landscape and shrinking the sense of what is possible. It has governed and skirmished, never settling for long. It's all about constantly drawing dividing lines, a former party strategist told me. That's all you need. It's not about big ideological debates or policies or anything. In many ways, the two momentous decisions of the period, what came to be known as austerity and Brexit, are now widely accepted as events that happened rather than as choices that were made. Starmer's Labour Party does not seek to reverse them. So basically everything we've talked about so far.
Right.
If you live in an old country, it can be easy to succumb to a narrative of decline. The state withers. The charlatans take over. You give up on progress to some extent and simply pray that this particular chapter of British nonsense will come to an end. It will. Rishi Sunak, the fifth and presumably final Conservative Prime Minister of the era, faces an election later this year, which he will almost certainly lose. But Britain cannot move on from the Tories without properly facing up to the harm they have caused. So we can...
No, we should leave it there. We've been going for an hour.
Yeah, that's and the rest gets into detail. I think we've basically covered what... I think we've had some good discussions about
yeah,
this.
Yeah, no, I think we've squeezed everything that we showed out of this article anyway. I mean, just in terms of, like, again, the framework that... I mean, it's wild that, like, he acknowledges that Keir Starmer...
Isn't going to change a fucking thing.
But, like, again, it's like that, like, oh, but, like, we just got to wait for the next one. We just got to wait for the next one, which we've been doing.
Yeah.
For, like, I mean, the entirety of my life. Like, if I can look back on the politics, the political, like, changes, quote unquote, over my life, like it's resulted in like this decline.
I mean, the interesting thing, some of the things he brings up later in this article are, I mentioned on this podcast a few times, I think, that I'm from Sunderland, and Sunderland's an extremely working class, relatively poor part of England. But our neighbor is Newcastle, and Newcastle is viewed as a relatively affluent part of the country. And he mentions in this that 45% of children in Newcastle currently live below the poverty line. So, I mean, like...
Quote, unquote, exactly. Third world country shit, yeah. Right?
And he talks about just the systematic defunding of parts of the country that are viewed as... Which I kind of touched on before, are viewed as labor so that they, you know, so that they can then use the argument that it's all... the immigrant's fault or whatever, you know, it's someone to blame. It's not your fault kind of thing, even though it's the fucking government's fault. And just, again, the systematic defunding of education, he goes through all of that. And it's all, you know, shit that we're seeing here. I mean, I don't know what the statistics are here, but it would be really interesting to see how many people in the South live below the poverty line now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at a state like Mississippi.
Yeah.
You know, like with literacy and poverty rates.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just one example.
Right.
And that's not a failure of the people that live in Mississippi.
No.
You know what I mean? It's a failure of like the history of that particular state, that region.
Yeah.
The racism, the exploitation that has wrought the conditions that we're living with today and the continuation of a system that is incapable and unwilling to actually correct things and improve the lot of the people that live there and actually made it like a rich place for some.
Yeah.
When it could be a rich place for all. Like that is one of the most fertile patches of ground in this entire country.
Right.
And that's why that's why it is what it is.
Yeah.
Because of the history. When you look at the history of this country, that's why it is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's really scary when you talk about all this stuff. And then you compound this with the fucking oncoming climate disaster that the world is going to see and how that's going to change just where people have to live.
Yeah.
What, you know, you see how the news portrays the, using quotes here, you know, immigrant crisis at the border or the crisis at the border in this country, and fucking climate change is going to just make certain parts of the world unlivable. And people are going to have to move. And, you know, what are we going to do then? And there's no, there's no introspective look on why people want to come here, right? It's just immigrant bad.
Yeah.
Why are we letting them in the country?
No, absolutely.
Not, oh, we've destroyed the economies of all of these other countries.
Yeah. And like the Great Lakes region is going to be a safe region when the climate catastrophe hits, you know?
Yeah. And England and Britain as well.
Right.
Britain's just somewhat, you know, is probably going to be somewhat, you know, for years, climate's going to change there, but it's not going to be as badly affected as the, you know, global South and other places.
I mean, I think for me, it's like I've already kind of hammered in on the points that I want to make about like the framing of the article, you know, but like I was telling you earlier, like I've been trying to get off social media and stuff. And yep. like part of that is for my mental health, but part of it is because like I want to live in the real fucking world, you know?
Yeah.
And like, honestly, like as I think as much as there's a place for podcasts like this and you know, many more that do it much better than us. Like, let's be real, you know, like,
yeah,
like we have a small and little core group of listeners that, you know, and we love you all dearly, but like, we need to get fucking real. Like we need to get real. Like we need to stop sitting online arguing and talking about like fucking like Stalin's mustache and everything like that. Like we can, you know, but like we can like uphold like the legacies of like socialist projects in history and shit like that. But we also have to get real about like how we're actually going to go out and organize like the working class and like make ourselves not like a bunch of fringe fucking weirdos on the internet. Like, I'm sorry. And like,
no,
and I'm not and again, not to diminish like what like, I know there's a lot of people. I'm one of them. I like to think, and I know a lot of people that are doing it, that are working on doing the hard work of organizing and trying to build this project. But like, again, we cannot like just say, oh, we're doing enough. Like we have to do more and we need more people, you know? And like, it's not enough to just be like correct, have the correct opinions online and everything like that. You know, like we need to go out and do the actual work and get serious because the crisis is fucking serious. Like this neoliberal project coming to an end is like a cataclysmic shift in terms of like, not just the politics of the US and Britain, but on the world stage, because it's been part of this global process of like the consolidation of the imperialist system, right? And like as these empires fall and as this system falls, the people that sit at the center of it are going to lash out violently as they're doing in fucking Gaza. You have no better example of it.
Right.
Like as this shit goes on in Gaza, the US with the UK and Tao are lashing out at Russia. They're building up militarily, preparing for confrontation with China. As material conditions deteriorate here in the imperial core, both in the UK and in the US. And again, like we can, I know the UK is not part of Europe anymore, quote unquote, because they're not in the European Union, but like, look at what the system is doing to like the German working class.
Yeah.
Right. Like the French working class in terms of like cutting them off of energy, just to discipline them. So like the richest can get richer.
Yeah.
And who, and like the richest people who this system actually works for, you know, but like we need to get serious and talk to like working people. Like we need to break out of our bubbles and pull them in like a real way.
Yeah. And you look at the news and you mentioned Ukraine and you mentioned China, but you look at the news, there's more and more stories about Taiwan now.
They're gearing up for it.
Yeah,
anybody definitely. That's paying attention can see it.
Yeah.
They're going to do the same in the same way that they weaponized Ukraine against Russia.
Yep.
And like the Donbass in particular, right?
Yep.
They're going to do the same thing with China. And like, they don't care that it like is ultimately going to fail and how many fucking Ukrainians die.
No.
It's like, is it going to weaken Russia to an extent that we deem acceptable? Will Taiwan weaken China? They'll try.
Yeah, they will.
They're going to try.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, again, like we need to build like, this true anti-imperialist socialist movement in the imperial core here. And the task is enormous.
Yeah.
It's enormous. And we have to get fucking serious about what that actually means.
Well, on that bright note.
Yeah. I'm serious. I've dealt with so much bullshit over the past couple months, dude. Like, I'm just like,
I know.
I'm just like, we got to get serious. We got to get real. But all right. Well, we're tentatively back in the saddle for now. Thanks for tuning back in. Go check like our backlog if you haven't listened to like the past few months. We've got some good stuff in there. We'll be back. We're going to get back in touch with Levi soon and figure out a schedule that works for us. I mean, to be brutally honest with y'all, I doubt we're ever going to get back to like a weekly schedule, at least in the foreseeable future, right. At least with all three of us, you know?
Yeah. There might be more of these bullshit episodes that we used to do, I guess. But even both of us have challenging schedules coming up.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm happy to do this shit. I enjoy it. So we'll do this fun. As much as we can.
Yep.
We'll get back with some more real stuff. I know Levi is still got some ideas.
And we still have a lot of projects that we are working on, but they're just taking time because there's a lot of other shit going on. So,
yep, definitely. But thanks for tuning in. We love y'all. Go out and get organized, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Adios, paisanos.